The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yeun, I'm joined by James Forsyth and Isabel Hardman. So today the Times is reporting quite an alarming headline that the US fears Afghanistan could fall to the Taliban within weeks. James, this obviously comes in the aftermath of the Western withdrawal from Afghanistan. And do you think it's happened sooner than we expected, the Taliban resurgence?
I don't think people are surprised by the fact the Taliban are advancing. The Taliban are not sticking by the so-called deals that they've made in these Doha talks. But I think what is surprising people is the speed of it. You know, Joe Biden was determined that to continue this US policy of withdrawal from Afghanistan, to have US troops out by the 20th anniversary of 9/11. Awful irony of this is that it now looks like you could have a situation where Kabul has fallen to the Taliban again by the 20th anniversary of 9/11. And we now see reports today in the New York Times that the US is attempting to kind of negotiate with the Taliban to ensure that its own embassy is not sacked if Kabul were to fall. Now, despite all of this, I don't think there is any sign of the US shifting its own position. Joe Biden has been very clear that he doesn't regret it, the decision to withdraw, and that, you know, he persists with this kind of quite sink or swim attitude that the Afghans need to kind of fight for themselves. I think it's also worth remembering that Joe Biden has been sceptical of what the US can achieve in Afghanistan for quite some time. There's a really interesting Tom Friedman piece written shortly after the pullout from Afghanistan, what was confirmed by Joe Biden, in which he discusses going to visit Afghanistan with Biden in 2002, and a subsequent discussion they've had about that visit, and how that left Biden with a sense of how difficult it would be to achieve much there, and the like. And we also know that the famous conversation that Joe Biden allegedly had with Richard Holbrooke, who was in kind of the Afghan-Pakistan coordinator for the Obama administration, when he's talking about his own son, Bo, obviously fought in the US military, saying, you know, I'm not sending my boy back there to fight for women's rights. He has quite a limited view of what the US mission in Afghanistan is. I personally think that this issue, though, reflects two mistakes. Right? One is obviously the humanitarian catastrophe that would follow, that looks like following the Taliban's advance. The second is that one of the reasons the US wants to get out of Afghanistan is it wants to concentrate on this great power conflict with China. I think one of the things that they are missing, though, is what the US leaving Afghanistan will do for people's views on the US's reliability as an ally. If you are, as a country in Asia, and wondering whether to shift more towards the US position now, this does send a worrying signal that, you know, that US strategic priorities might change again in 20 years' time, and you might have taken this hard-line stance on China, alienated yourself from a lasting power in the region, only to find that the country on whose behalf you did it has now decided to flit its attention elsewhere. And I think that is probably the biggest single risk for the US, is that it raises this question about how reliable a security ally is the United States.
Isabel, what's the risk for Downing Street? We've heard about the former defence ministers Tobias Elwood and Johnny Mercer campaigning for a more lenient way of getting Afghan interpreters back. And also, you know, headlines like this surely doesn't look good for the British government to have been kind of complicit in a withdrawal.
Yeah, I mean, the argument from the MOD is that they weren't complicit in a withdrawal, but it is impossible for them to remain, for British troops to remain in Afghanistan without the US's presence as well. And this goes back to what James is saying about the reliability of the US as an ally in interventions or in an ongoing military presence in another country. We can look back over the past 20 years and look at the naivety of successive leaders, not just in the sort of the early days of thinking that the Allies could nation build in this country, that there would be a lasting legacy, that the naivety of talking about mission accomplished and naivety of thinking, particularly with regards to Afghanistan, that this was going to be an intervention that was going to be different to all the others in the past. But as Johnny Mercer has said, this is something that is going to be felt by the UK for a very long time in terms of the ramifications of pulling troops out so quickly and of watching the Taliban recapturing territory. And, you know, the number of provincial cities that have just fallen in the past week have shown quite how strong the Taliban are, and the risks to the wider region and indeed to the world of a space that is ungoverned, or indeed that has room for new terror groups to start growing again in Afghanistan, is something that is really worrying those who are watching the country.
James, taking a step back, this kind of foreign policy seems pretty isolationist from a Biden administration in charge of America. And I mean, surely liberal-minded people wasn't quite expecting something like this, having had Biden in power rather than Trump.
Yeah, I think it's certainly a policy that if the Trump administration was pursuing it, people would be more vocal in criticising it. I think, as Isabel says, it is striking that Ben Wallace, the Defence Secretary, talked about how the UK looked to whether it could leave a force in Afghanistan to try and deter this kind of thing. I think one of the ironies is that after 20 years, the US had actually found a kind of a way of, with a relatively small force, deterring the Taliban from taking such steps. But I think this is going to be a stain on the Biden administration. I think this is a quite conscious decision to do it. And I think these negotiations about the embassy are clearly about avoiding scenes that are reminiscent of the US pullout from Vietnam. But the speed with which this is moving and the Taliban's behaviour makes it A, hard to think that they will not reach Kabul sooner rather than later, and B, makes it difficult to believe that once they reach Kabul, they're going to respect international embassies and the like. And I think there is a real risk here to the message it sends about America's reliability. But but I think what you can see quite clearly is that, you know, the Pentagon won't even confirm that US air support will continue to the Afghan forces after the 31st of August. So I see very little sign that the Biden administration are considering changing their approach.
And Isabel, back in Westminster, there are rumours that Cressida Dick might not be long for her job as Metropolitan Police Chief. What are the rumours going on here?
Well, there's been long-term frustration with the Metropolitan Police Chief. I think it's fair to say it existed before the murder of Sarah Everard and the policing decisions around the vigils following her death, but it obviously escalated quite a lot in the aftermath of that. There have also been scandals within the Met, not just obviously that Wayne Cousins, who has now pleaded guilty to her kidnap, rape and murder, was at the time a serving Metropolitan Police officer and had indecent exposure allegations made against him prior to the murder, but also that the behaviour of other police officers involved in the investigation into Sarah Everard's death was also something that was called into question. Now she's been talking about Extinction Rebellion and their decision to start protesting again in London and how disappointed she is in that. And again, we'll see a debate, I think, over the policing of that versus the policing of other demonstrations on other issues. But there is a suggestion that ministers didn't want to back her in staying in her role for much longer. But I'm not entirely clear whether that's actually the case or not. To a certain extent, she has managed to survive a large number of scandals, and her position doesn't look any rockier than it has done over the past year or so, I'd say.
I think one of the things that is protecting Cressida Dick is the way in which she would have to be reappointed, with the London mayor and the Home Secretary agreeing on her replacement. I mean, you know, I don't think Sadiq Khan and Priti Patel would agree on very much, and I think that process would be difficult. And I also think that, for example, you know, if Cressida Dick goes, I think it's very likely that Sadiq Khan would push the claims of Neil Basu, which would cause some embarrassment for the government. You know, he is on record as having said that, you know, Boris Johnson's past, his words, not mine, racist statements would rule him out from joining the Metropolitan Police. So I think for those reasons, reasons, I think Cressida Dick's position is relatively safe. I mean, obviously, these Extinction Rebellion protests that we were talking about just before we went on air, obviously, those end up grinding London to a halt regularly and repeatedly, there will be lots of kind of irate Tory MPs as well as irate commuters and city dwellers. I think that Dick's position, despite all the listening of issues that Isabel mentioned, is probably more secure than you might think it is because of the way that her successor would have to be chosen.
Well, I hear that Dido Harding is looking for a job after not achieving the NHS England role, so maybe that's one for her. James and Isabel, thanks very much for joining this episode, and thank you for listening. Do join us again tomorrow.